Welcome back to Drilling Deeper. We've got a couple Hall of Fame interviews on tap. Pitt & Corey Hall of Famers Tom Hill and Neil Heiss we're going to hear from today. But first, let me welcome in Jack Kapansky. Of course, I should probably introduce myself. I'm Kevin Yannick, the editor of the magazine, and I've got my fearless partner Jack with us once again. Jack, what's going on?
How's it going, Kevin? Good to be back. Another week, another podcast.
Episode 13. Let's hope it's lucky 13.
Yeah. Excited to hear from Tom and Neil. They had some good stuff to say here. Excited to put their interviews in, and we'll kind of let them run the show today. It'll be nice.
Yeah, different areas of expertise, I would say, for these two. You know, Tom obviously lived on the business side of our industry, doing acquisition after acquisition at a couple of companies, including Summit Materials, and Neil more on the manufacturing side. So, you know, looking forward to diving in with them here shortly. But Jack, let's hear a word from our episode sponsor first.
Yeah, thanks as always to Geologic for sponsoring this episode. Geologic uses scientific investigation and engineering design to provide innovative solutions to the most challenging mining, construction, and development issues in a safe, effective, and cost-efficient manner. When it needs to be done right the first time, call Geologic at 770-824-4212. Thank you to Geologic.
Yes, thank you. Well, again, we're going to hear from Tom Hill and Neil Heiss today, and we're going to kick it off with our interview with Tom Hill. Jack and I were fortunate at the Ag One show at the end of March to bring a variety of folks into the Pitt & Corey booth, and I think Tom was either our first or second interview that we had, and of course, many of you know who've listened to the podcast and read the magazine, you know, Tom and Neil were two of our four inductees for the 2024 class of the Pitt & Corey Hall of Fame. Congratulations again to Tom and Neil Heiss, and same to Charlie Luck and Lewis Johnson. We had a great ceremony, and, you know, it was great to see Tom, Neil, and the others kind of get their moment on stage at our black tie ceremony, and Tom came by the booth in the hours before the induction ceremony and kind of just paused and reflected on the industry. This is a man who did a lot in his career, and it sounds like there's potentially another chapter to his story to come here, Jack. What's your recollection, you know, as we did this interview with Tom just a couple weeks back? What did you kind of take away?
Yeah, I know. I think one of the more interesting things that I'm pretty sure you asked him about was kind of having him walk us through, you know, what a deal looks like. This is a guy that has done or did 187 acquisitions during his time with Oldcastle, did countless more during his time with Summit, the company that he founded. And I think he mentioned during his Hall of Fame speech, I think between Oldcastle and Summit, I think he said it was somewhere near or possibly over 300.
Astounding.
It's unbelievable, really. And, you know, just to be able to have the intelligence to do something like that and to do it so much and so well is really astounding and kind of shows why he is in our Hall of Fame. And, you know, you'll hear in the interview near the end that his end in aggregates is not yet. You know, he's kind of stepped away for a little bit, but he's hoping to get back in it. And I think the industry will be better off for it if that's the case. So, yeah, looking forward to hopefully seeing Tom Hill back around aggregates soon.
Yeah, we'll be sure to cover that if or when that happens. But without further ado, let's hear our interview with Tom Hill. We're excited to be here at Ag One Aggregates Academy and Expo in Nashville. It's Jack Kapansky and I, and we've got Tom Hill, one of our inductees of the 2024 Pitt & Corey Hall of Fame class with us. Tom, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great to be in Nashville.
It's been a while, I guess, since we had an Ag One in Nashville, a couple of years, and we're looking forward to tonight's induction ceremony as we've got Neil Heiss going in with you along with Charlie Luck and Lewis Johnson, you know, the late founder of LJ Manufacturing. You know, we asked Neil, he was in the booth just a little while ago, about, you know, his experience with those guys. Do you know Charlie at all, or do you know those other inductees too? Or
I've known Charlie, and I knew his dad, you know, for a long time. I mean, that was sort of what I did was, you know, go around and introduce myself to sort of the whole industry with the object, obviously not successfully with Charlie, but with the object, if they ever needed to sell their business, that they would call us and not J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, that was kind of one of the things I took away from your interview with Jack, was how at one time that's where producers were looking or turning when they were going to sell their business, and now very much that's changed. The nature of M&A has changed a little bit, and you know, we were just talking a little bit before we sat down here, and it seems like M&A is very healthy. I think it was kind of in question last year a little bit because turn the economy and inflation and interest rates getting a little bit high, so people were, you know, maybe a little bit more reserved, but we just continue to see deals get done, and we've seen some big ones done lately.
Yeah, you know, certainly the M&A market in the heavy building materials sector is very, very healthy. You know, you've seen very large deals. I think there's been a few more moderate to smaller deals done, But I still think the industry, compared to many other industries, is still relatively fragmented. So there's still opportunity out there. But there's, you know, there's a lot of buyers. There's a lot of buyers with a lot of cash. The industry is very healthy, so you know, businesses' results are very good. And as a result, they've got a lot of cash. And there's a lot of competition out there for deals right now. I'm glad I started my business in 2009 at Summit and not today. That's for sure.
Right, you talk about starting Summit in 2009, and that came after, you know, nearly three decades at Old Castle. You know, I'm just curious, and I know we, you know, talked a little bit about this for our interview for your profile, but you know, what were maybe some lessons or experiences you took from Old Castle when starting Summit?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about that tonight, but CRH is a great company, great people. You know, I happen to have a mentor there, a guy named Don Gotson, who founded Old Castle back in the, you know, the late 70s, and you know, had this wonderful culture of treating everyone with the same amount of respect, and you know, that I tried to keep with me for a long, long, long time, forever really, especially when I started Summit. So it was, you know, when I left in 08, I thought I was going to get the CEO job back in Dublin. I didn't get it. And the only reason I really left, because I loved what I did, was I was really getting tired of going to Ireland every month. I had a young family, and that is a tough slog back and forth every month. So I just left. We moved to our summer house in Wyoming. I had no job, no money, and started Summit. And that was exciting.
What was your vision for Summit? I mean, when did this idea pop into your head that you wanted to do something like Summit Materials? And I wanted to ask, too, so 6 years after it was established, the company goes public. I mean, was that part of the original vision, or did that just come later?
You know, I got very lucky. I had a great friend, still have a great friend, Ted Gardner, who was in the private equity world, and he was a fraternity brother of mine at Duke. And we kept in contact. And, you know, when I left CRH, he sort of called me and said, hey, let's do what you did at Old Castle Materials, but let's do it for us. And three of us, Ted, myself, and a guy named Chip Goodyear, who had just left as CEO of BHP Billiton, each threw in money and we formed Summit. Hired a few Old Castle people, opened an office in D.C., and just started a business. And we were very fortunate to hook up with Blackstone as an equity source. And that was like literally had nothing to do one afternoon in New York as we were pounding the pavement looking for people to back us. And it's 09 now, so the world has just ended. And we, I said I knew a guy at Blackstone that we'd looked at some very large deals with CRH, a guy named Neil Simpkins, and I said, let's go see Neil. Having no thought, zero thought, that he would be interested in a startup, because they don't really do startups. They just bought Hilton for $22 billion. And I'm like, you know, they're not going to do an 8-page PowerPoint. But we went to see him, and a week later, we had a commitment letter for $750 million. So
Wow. We're
off to the races. And I was usually disappointed when I left CRH, but it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. And again, CRH is a first-class company with great people, and they've done fantastic the last few years for sure.
Right. Kevin mentioned you taking the company public 6 years after starting it. And I know when we talked that you mentioned that, you know, that was one of your more fond memories, one of the great experiences of being with Summit. And I know some of the photos that you sent and that I've been able to look at are just great. Seeing you ring the bell, seeing your friends and family there. Just what was that experience like? I'm sure that has to be unlike anything you've done.
It was surreal. And I didn't answer your original question was, you know, that Blackstone was one of the reasons not only did we like their money, but we like their MO was to take companies public so that it would continue. A lot of private equity firms, you know, just look at 3 or 4 or 5 years, do a bunch of deals, make it better, and sell it. Okay, they tended to use the public markets. Not for sure, but we really thought that was a likely outcome. And they, as we did, but it was surreal. And the interesting story was we were supposed to go in early January of 2015. You know, they still have a big operation in Texas, and the oil price cratered. And we were poised to go start, you know, to launch the next day. And we pulled the plug at like 8 o'clock the night before because with oil price declining, people looked at Texas negatively. And so we had to then wait until March, and that turned out to be great timing. And it was it went great from the first meeting on. We were 11 or 12 times oversubscribed. And the way that works is, you know, Blackstone, we sold 20% of the business in public shares, and Blackstone didn't sell any of theirs. It was strictly to pay off debt because we were, you know, private equity uses debt pretty liberally. And so we raised, I don't know, $400 or $500 million and just paid off debt. And then we just ran the business, and it was fun. It was really surreal, especially, like you said, to have my family. Almost everybody on that die was a longtime friend, colleague, family, and it was really surreal. It's really hectic because it's only like 10 days, and, you know, they hire you a plane, and you go from city to city. You have from 6 in the morning, you're on with Europe, until 7 at night. You do 12, 14 meetings a day, and, you know, it was, but it went well from the start, so it was really fun.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I wanted to ask if you could take us behind the scenes of what a deal coming together looks like. But Jack had written that at Oldcastle CRH, you were a part of 187 transactions, and I was trying to do the math based on how long you were there, and I'm like, man, there's deals constantly going on. It's not like you're doing one at a time. I mean, you're doing many at a time. So how is that managed, and I guess what makes for a good deal, what makes for a deal that's not a match?
You know, I think the secret that we have, first off, we had fantastic people like Michael Brady, you know, Damien. I see all of our operating guys, like Damien, were also acquisition guys. So first off, having great people. The second is that we knew people for a long time before they would sell their business. Like probably, you know, of the close to 300 deals that I've done between CRH and Summit and so on, probably two-thirds of them have been proprietary. And some of the bigger ones, like if you're in Utah, I called on Val Staker for 2 years before he ended up selling the business to us. The Parson family was years and years. Robert Hall, who will be here tonight, I knew him for a whole bunch of number of years. And all those were negotiated deals. So, you know, if you know someone for, you know, sometimes the Hinkle family that we bought in Kentucky, I think I knew them for 25 years before they sold to us. So, you know, it makes it relatively easy. Now, you know, the biggest determinant on a good deal versus a bad deal is always timing in the economy. You know, if you bought something in 08, it was a bad deal, no matter how good it was. You know, if you bought something in 19, it's a good deal almost no matter what. So, you know, that's the first thing. Second thing is people. Do the people stay? Are they motivated? I was always amazed at these entrepreneurs, and that was by far and away the most fun of my job, was getting to know these entrepreneurs, like Robert. A lot of times it wasn't about getting the highest price for their business. It was about getting a good price and doing it with someone that they trusted and knew. And then the second thing, what really amazed me, you give someone tens of millions of dollars and they show up Monday at 6 o'clock and go to work. Mm-hmm. I'm just like,
and nothing changed. They
might buy a plane. They might, they might buy a bigger house. It's really a unique business in that way, because these are hard-working folks that were successful, great leadership, incredible integrity in the industry also. You know, guys, you know, you did business with these people. It was, they told you this is what was going to happen, it happened.
Mm-hmm. Tom, one of the things that I think stuck out to me the most when looking over your career to this point was the experience and time you spent as chairing or as part of the different associations and boards throughout the industry. And, you know, obviously a lot of advocacy involved in that. So kind of a two-part question. One, what was that like spending time with the NSSGAs, with the ARPAs, with different associations throughout the industry? And two, from an advocacy point of view, where do you feel like the aggregate industry is on sort of its public image, its, you know, the way it's presenting itself, and hopefully, you know, reversing some of the negative stereotypes around the industry?
Yeah, and you know, that's a tough one. And then this, you know, the world is so different. And even since I retired, the world is so different. So I'm not sure I have a really good answer for that, but I know we need to do more of it.
Right.
I'm not sure what it is, but we need to do more of it. And, you know, I've always been a big fan of associations. I've been involved with so many of them. And I'm still treasurer of ARTBA. You know, so funding is important, obviously, but the regulatory and the PR – you know, ability to get permits, all of those things. And so a lot of them are local, and then a lot of them are more, you know, national. And, you know, regulations are coming out of Washington faster than you can count. So we need to keep the advocacy up. And I think these associations do a great job.
Mm-hmm. Tom, absolutely. On Jack's question and what we're discussing here, are you concerned that we're going to get to a point, maybe years or probably more decades from now, are we going to get to a point where certain markets, like, we're just not able to open up new quarries via greenfield? And then what happens?
Well, then the price goes up dramatically.
Yeah.
As we've seen in the last, I mean, I think the prices in the last 3 years have gone up more than they have in the last 15 in total, not just on an annual basis. So I think that's going to present some issues. I do think you'll see a supply cycle now where you will see more quarries. Because if you raise the price high enough in City A, someone 50 miles away who can get a permit, you're not going to get a permit within 30 miles of City A, but you might get one 50 miles. And if price is high enough, you can ship in. And you're seeing that in the cement industry, which isn't part of your purvey, but it's now attracting imports. I think you're going to see increased supply. There are some markets, like, you're not going to get a quarry, you know, in medium to large cities within 20 or 30 miles. So it's, to me, it's just that next layer out that's going to, and I think you're going to see some more greenfields.
Yeah. Well, you know, one last question for me here, Tom. Just, you know, we've obviously, you know, just spent a lot of time discussing a lot of the different aspects of your career, sort of what you've done up to this point. And obviously that sort of long list is a great indication of, you know, sort of why you're here for the Hall of Fame and the induction coming up later tonight. So I'm just curious, you know, what was your initial response? What was your reaction? And what are you feeling right now, just a few hours away from being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Well, first off, I miss the industry. That's probably my first thought. Second is, it's a huge honor. And I feel hugely honored. I feel very lucky to have been in this industry. You know, when you grow up in suburban New York, you know, you don't think you're going to crush rock for 40 years, but it turned out that way, and I'm very fortunate to have had it that way.
Absolutely.
Tom, what's ahead for you? What's next? And then I wanted to ask separately, the state of the industry today versus the one that you got into several decades ago, I guess, do you feel like we're in a better spot? There's a lot of different dynamics at play, or, you know, you talk about the labor issues we have today, or we talked about permitting already. You know, we're struggling in some areas, but we're growing and seeing some wins in others. I guess, where are we today in terms of, you know, where we were versus,
you know, I think the biggest thing is it took us, 30 years to get a highway bill, a decent highway bill. We got it. That's going to underpin the industry from a demand standpoint for, you know, the next 5 years. So that's a huge positive. I think consolidation is going to continue, and I'd be very surprised if we don't see big deals. You know, what happens when a business grows and it gets to be, you know, the Martin Vulcan, CRH, whatever size. No, the little deals don't do it. And all of a sudden, you have no debt. You've paid off all your debt. You really need to do something. So I'd be surprised if we don't see more and bigger deals. That would be number one. And we'll see how the movement away from four-year degrees to vocational, you know, whether that adds more people to the labor force. Because that's a real problem right now. And everybody I talk to, they can't get drivers. You can't get people to work. And
anybody, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we'll see. That's a big push, and I know, you know, I'm sure every one of the businesses here spends time at trade schools and vocational schools and high schools and whatever, saying this is, you know, it's a great job with, you know, pay's getting better and better, so you get good benefits. So it's a great alternative for young people.
I shouldn't have buried my other question, but do you see yourself getting involved? You're already with ARTBA right now. I mean, what might be next for you,
you know,
with the industry or outside?
You know, I might look at getting – I'm on one advisory board. There might be another one or two there. I'd be disappointed if I'm, you know, not involved with a, you know, a specific business on an acquisition side over the next few years. But, you know, it's all to play for now. And, you know, most important thing for me now is my family. And I've got one equestrian working in Europe, and I have one who's a high school senior, and I'm going from here to tour four or five colleges to look at. So that's my number one job. But I do want to keep a hand in the business and really I just like it.
It's a good industry. It's, you have a hard time finding somebody who's not a good person, or rare to find that jerk. But I guess They're in every industry, but this is a very good industry.
And this is an industry where people like to work. And, you know, that's what I like about it. And if you're not a hard worker, you need to go somewhere else.
Yeah, we do share that value for the most part, largely.
I think pretty much universally, really.
Yeah. Well, Tom, again, thanks for being so gracious with your time.
Thanks, guys.
Congratulations.
Congrats on the enshrinement later on this evening.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that was Tom Hill, 2024 Pit & Quarry Hall of Famer, founder of Summit Materials. Tom, thanks again for joining us. Yeah, it is amazing when you think about the change of our industry. And Tom obviously talked about that and how industry consolidation, you know, the bigger companies getting bigger, and Summit was obviously one of them, you know, established, I guess, a couple decades ago almost at this point. You know, I think about the things that we're continuously talking about and the things that interest our readers, Jack, and M&A is always, you know, one of those things. I feel like here in 2024, we continue to see deals get done, even though the financing environment and the market environment isn't necessarily perfect or ideal for that, but there's a lot of confidence out there right now. And I think, you know, as we saw Tom do almost 300 deals in the course of his career, you know, we continue to see, you know, Summit, Martin Marietta, Vulcan, big companies, public producers continue to go about trying to grow via M&A, and that's kind of growth path number one for any producer looking to grow, because as you know, it's just hard to bring a greenfield online these days with permitting challenges and challenges with localities and municipalities.
Yeah, 100%. And that's something that our next interview with Neil Heiss, he kind of got into in his induction speech, talking about, you know, so many of the regulations and so many of the permits and all sort of the red tape needed to, like you said, open a greenfield site. So having the ability to grow a company via mergers and acquisitions, I know for me that those are kind of always some of the more exciting pieces of news that we get across our desk every once in a while. As you see, like you mentioned, a Martin Marietta, Summit, a Vulcan making a multi-billion dollar purchase of, you know, a different operation or a different company. And it's just kind of, it's kind of wild to see the scope to which these companies are growing and the scope that these companies already have. And obviously Tom was a big part of that. So appreciate him taking the time to talk with us and be on the podcast here. He's obviously a wealth of information and a very deserving Hall of Famer. Transitioning a little bit from the producer to the manufacturer side, like I mentioned, we also got a chance to sit down with Neil Heiss ahead of the induction ceremony. Neil is another guy that you kind of want to just sit down, have a cold beverage with, and listen to him just tell stories. I mean, that guy has had a life for sure. You know, from growing up around crushers and, you know, aggregate operations, riding his tricycle around literally probably 30 feet from a crusher, playing in ponds near big pieces of equipment, to, you know, he spent some time serving in Vietnam. He's an avid flyer. You know, he loves spending time with his grandchildren. I mean, this guy, you could spend a week with this guy and you probably wouldn't run out of stories. So certainly a character, certainly a great guy to talk with, and another very well-deserving Hall of Famer. Like I think you mentioned going into this, sort of his big contribution, the VSI Turbo Crusher during his time with Semco. So yeah, Neil was just, it was great to kind of talk to Neil about how he's seen the aggregate industry change in his multiple decades in it, sort of what it was like creating such a revolutionary piece of equipment in the VSI Turbo, what it was like kind of getting that into market initially, because it wasn't easy. But yeah, just another wealth of information and a very well-deserving Hall of Famer. So let's hear from Neil Heiss. All right, and we are joined here by Neil Heiss, class of 2024 Pit & Quarry Hall of Fame inductee, second-generation owner of Semco and longtime president of the company. Neil, thank you so much for joining us here at Ag One.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yeah, you know, as I mentioned, you know, one of the four members of this year's Hall of Fame class, alongside Tom Hill, Lewis Johnson, and Charlie Luck IV, obviously a very deserving recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to kind of start this off by asking, you know, what was your initial response when you found out you were going to be in the Hall of Fame, and what's it like being here now on Hall of Fame Day, just a few hours away from being inducted?
I hope I'm prepared. You know, I'm floored by being honored in this manner. To me, I'm just a ordinary guy that built crushers for a while and tried to make them as good as we can make them. The object was to make the customer money, not, you know, not just us. And that's how the customers stay happy, is when they're going along and they don't have a lot of problems and they're making product. And that's our whole focus. And so I'm truly honored to be here and represent my company and my family, because this really isn't just me. It's a family. It's a family business. My wife is the gal with the brains behind it and the ability to educate us on the money, the proper money flow, and she's an accountant that was just incredible. Without her, I'd probably not amount to much, but I've got a daughter that's now, has been in the game for a long time, and she, a superior bought us in October, and it was something that I thought I would never end up doing, but the government makes it very, very difficult to stay in business as a mom and pop thing, and we were fairly big, shipped to 30 countries across the world, and it's an adventure. It's been 61 years of working, and you get up one day and you don't have a job. You know, I'm going, whoa, what is this? And so we're getting used to that. It's an emotional thing to go through. It's a difficult thing to go through, but it's a good thing. And we were blessed by having Superior look at us. They're a wonderful company. They're also a family company, and but bigger. And they're also a worldwide company, but bigger. And so their culture is quite similar to ours. So we're very, very pleased and very, very honored. And to be recognized on top of that, I mean, that's just wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm just overwhelmed. And am I nervous? I feel some. The problem, if you hand me a microphone like you just did, you know, I may just chatter up a storm and never let you have it back. So,
well, Neil, congrats again on your enshrinement to be here in a few hours. I was going to ask too. You know, Jack and I keep talking internally about this class in particular, and you know, it's a heavyweight class. You know, got some big names. You know, Charlie Luck, Lewis Johnson.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
When you think of those names, maybe some you knew better than others, but what comes to mind as you think about those other gentlemen?
Well, I've actually been in Charlie Luck's office and talked to him about crushers and seen him oftentimes in the NSSGA meetings, and he is truly a leader in producer names. Lewis Johnson, I knew him back in the day, and that's a lot of years ago when he was building, when he first came out with this roller cone, and we had talked about VSIs and cones working together, and they do. So he's quite the man, and he built a heck of a good crusher, and for a long time, it was the crusher with this new roller game, roller bearing, and so it was pretty special. Tom Hill, I don't know as well as I should, so I can't really say too much about him. But what I found here in this meeting last night and in this weekend is the relationships that I have built over this period of time that I belong to NSA and then NAA and then NSSGA and all the progressions that happen in our lives with time. As time goes by, you build friendships, you build relationships with dealers, with producers, with competitors, customers, and I love this industry. I mean, there are some absolutely fabulous people in this thing, and it doesn't make any difference where in the world you go, and I have been blessed by being able to travel to some of the most third world areas that you could possibly imagine, and everyone in them, every person in a crusher pit is trying to make a better life for their family. You know, it's just an amazing thing. I am astounded when you go to the jungles of Malaysia and you're in a crusher pit there, and they don't have shaker screens. They've got a little old guy with a stick working the stick to get the stuff to go through the screens, and they got so much water because it rains all the time in the jungles that you end up with some sort of efficiency. I don't know what it would be because it'd be pretty hard to measure, but they get by, you know, and they're working hard so that they can make a better life for their family. And that's our industry in a nutshell. And that's what you guys are doing when you think about it. And you're part of the industry because you understand it and you're learning about it and you're knowing about it. So I appreciate that.
You know, you talk about making a better life for your family, and that's obviously something that, you know, your father did in purchasing Crusher Service Company that ultimately became Semco. Mm-hmm. You know, you ended up obviously following in his footsteps, and Jennifer shortly before Superior bought Semco. You know, can you just kind of talk about that unique dynamic of being able to work so closely with your wife, with your daughter, with your father back in the day, and sort of how special that was?
You know, that's the hardest thing in the world, to work for family, because they chew on you when you make a mistake, and they never forget, you know. And so it's a difficult thing. It's not difficult. It just sometimes it is overwhelming, because when you're going along, you try not to make any mistakes because you don't want to make any mistakes. But I had a really interesting conversation with my friend Jeff Sikora of Hazmag Saturday morning, and we were just laughing together because he's a good friend. He said, between us, we've made so many mistakes making the Crushers right. That's how we learn how to make it right. So when you're in the family is not as forgiving as when you're working for somebody else, because the family is part of the mistake. Whether you made it or they made it, it doesn't make any difference. But no, my daughter Jennifer has actually been in the company for about 20 years, more than that, 24 years, I think. We've been blessed by having employees and two son-in-laws, for example, that have been there for 23 years and 20 years. And I've got other employees that have been there for 30 and 35 years. So we had a heck of a team that could build anything. And that's what was so neat for me, is I could go out into the shop and understanding a problem a customer might have and say, hey, guys, we need to build it like this. And then I'd wave my hands, and then I'd go away, and they'd come back, and it was built. It was there. It was also. And I'm going, wow, you know, these. So, again, this honor is for the family, for my wife, my daughter, my son-in-laws, my team that was there, Superior, who is also, I think they're also in Pit and Quarry Hall of Fame. But again, it's for all of those folks. It's an honor to represent them. I mean, it truly is. So,
Neil, I wanted to ask too, you said 61 years, that's how many you put into the agri industry.
Yep.
You know, I know, having read some of Jack's coverage of you and you're knowing your story a little bit, it had to be a vastly different industry 6 decades ago versus today. So is it a better industry today? Do you like where the industry's come, and where do you think we're going?
Very unfortunately, the government is in the way. The government makes, well, the pictures I sent you, some of them are when I'm 2 years old on a tricycle in a
awesome pictures.
I'll say probably one of my favorite of the photos you sent.
It's in a highway construction camp, and then there's one in 1954 or so where I'm, I don't know, 6 or 7 maybe, and we're playing in the stream, and there's a crusher in the background. Okay, nobody got eaten by crushers. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got killed because everybody's watching out for everybody. Well, the government said, well, you know, you mashed your finger, so now you have to have a rule that says no kids. And I have 2 grandsons, 14 and 15, that were working in our shop. And, you know, it's gray area. But if you teach them lightly, make sure they wear in the protective equipment, they can learn how to weld, they can learn how to cut, they can learn how to sweep. You don't have them doing sweeping. You don't have them pulling weeds. Show them something that's going to make. They make something. They use their brain. They use their ability to mathematically understand measuring and cutting, and it all fits. So our government has made being in business incredibly difficult. Is it a better industry? It's a good industry. It's an honorable way to make a living with your hands and produce material that makes our society better, better roads, better highways, better buildings. Everything comes from the ground, and it, you know, everything on this table, the plastic here, comes from oil drilling and such. We're upside down here, and I worry about our country. I worry about my grandkids, and I worry about you guys, because you're young. Both of you are young, and, you know, I have seen things in my lifetime that are sometimes it's very discouraging, you know, and yet we can't just throw up our hands and go, oh, you know, we're all going to die. Well, no, eventually we're going to die, but you want to do the best you can while you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're at.
Right. Neil, obviously, you know, you're one of, if not your biggest impact on the industry, you know, being the vertical shaft impact crusher, the VSI. You know, I think one of the more interesting things from the conversations we had was the way you talked about how that kind of came about due to a necessity of sort of, you know, the material in New Mexico. And, you know, you told me the great story about you would spend weekends repairing roll crushers and the time and effort that went into that, and just sort of realizing there had to be a better way. Can you just kind of give us a sense of what it was like in that time, sort of, that transition between roll crushers and VSIs and sort of figuring out a way to make that work?
Back in the day, roll crushers were predominantly how you made chips and sand. And you would set a set of rolls at a half inch apart and try to make half inch material. And in Rocky Mountain West, where there's predominantly granite and gnarly stuff like that, those roll shells will wear out. You spend all weekend from Friday night to Sunday night welding on them 10 pounds an hour with the manual way to do it. And then there became an automatic way to do it, but the automatic way would heat the roll shells too hot and they'd break. So you generally ended up better with manually welding, and it was called a two-tone process. That's how you could get up to the 10 pounds an hour. You used a big welding rod, and then you melted in some chrome wire or some manganese or something to build the roll shells up. But I particularly despised that because I was young then. I would much rather be chasing young girls, you know, and driving a hot rod car. But
absolutely, it
didn't work out that way. So I spent my time working. And I kept having these conversations with my dad. I said, there has got to be a better way. And the concept of a VSI existed. There was a tornado crusher and there was a simplicity crusher. And both of them had different unique ways of working, but they didn't work because the quality of the castings that you need to make these VSIs work didn't exist. And so my dad and the gentleman that owned the foundry that we got this welding rod from, we said, hey, can you produce some parts that look like this out of this welding rod? And the gentleman said, I don't see why not. And that's kind of how it started. And so we modified and invented our own crusher. And we knew, I don't know how we knew, I've been thinking about this since you and I have been talking. How do we know, when did we know that the speed is the critical thing, the rotation of the table. That's the critical thing that makes them work. And everything about our crushers, from number one to however many we have, because there was a day we didn't know we were going to be a manufacturer, and we didn't have tracking like we have today. So I don't know how many are out there. But anyway, the speed is what makes them work. And we tried to make ours hydraulic driven, and we connected direct, and that didn't work. So that just about broke the company, because there's some things that happen inside of a VSI that create enormous pressure on hydraulic systems that destroy it. And the way you get around that is what they do nowadays is you have a hydraulic motor over here and some belts, and you drive the pedestal with the belts. And the belts absorb this incredible shock that comes from crushing inside the VSI. So we have studied the VSI for many, many years. And they will crush anything, and it's just a matter of how much does it cost. Mm-hmm. And so if you're truthful with your customer, that either works for them or doesn't work for them, and you don't want to tell them something that's not true, because then you develop an enemy rather than somebody who appreciates your effort. So to me, the relationships that we've developed with every customer and every dealer are super important, and you need to be a man of your word, and you need to be able to say, this is the truth, and it is, versus, well, this, you're going to like this because it'll do everything you want it to do. And that's hogwash, you know. It's going to have some drawbacks somewhere.
It wasn't necessarily the easiest sell either. It sounded like it took a couple of years for the market to take to it.
That first one, we drug it all over New Mexico trying to sell it. And
it was about 2 years, right?
It was 2 years. And then a mine had a 3,000 horsepower ball mill that wasn't working, and they were going to spend X amount of thousands of dollars to repair it. And we said, well, I think we can do that with our little crusher. And it was about half the cost of the repair. And they said, we'll try it. So they experimented with us, and it was based on a relationship of trust. And we put it in, and lo and behold, it worked. And they not only they didn't use 3,000 horsepower, they only used 150 horsepower, but we made more material. They ended up buying seven crushers in that one. No, there's three crushers in that one plant and seven in another plant. And it's predominantly the crusher of choice for that particular material. So there's a lot of those things that happen because you worked at it, but also God's looking out after us, basically.
You know, in that time, obviously, you know, you're somewhat recently retired of as, you know, as of a couple of years ago.
Oh, no, October.
As of October, excuse me. You know, in that time, what has it been like seeing or working with the VSI to, you know, sort of adapt it and evolve it as, you know, needs go and as, you know, sort of the new technology and equipment becomes available for it?
It's always a challenge when a customer brings you something and says, can you crush this? And the latest thing, since Superior took on our whole team and all the expertise that we had, Joseph, my son-in-law, is dealing with a customer that wants to crush batteries. And by golly, you can recycle batteries. Not big ones, the double A's and the 9-volters and things. I have no idea how that works. But if they need it crushed, we can crush it. What do you do with it? I don't know. You know, but if it's working for them and they make money, name of the game. And that to me, the challenge is, can we somehow help the customer? You know, what is it we do? We help the customer make something big, something small. And it's just a lot of fun. It's an adventure. It's been a hell of an adventure.
You know, coming back to Ag One, I'm not sure how regularly you get out to shows anymore. You know, national shows like this one or Con Expo, but, you know, seeing old friends, getting the opportunity to check out the show this week. Ag One's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You know, what are you looking forward to being here in Nashville?
Well, I had the chance to give one of my crushers a hug. It's in Superior's colors now, but it's the same crusher. So they have the same quality, and I'm very, very pleased about that. And I get to see the friends I've made, and they're all old gray hairs like me, you know. It's really in our conversations, our gray, and I've heard the word gray tsunami. When you talk about Lewis Johnson, he's gone. And the dealer here that was a wonderful dealer here in Nashville, he's gone. So whenever you lose one of the gray hairs, you lose all that they've learned in their lifetime. So how do we get that to you guys? How do we get that to our new customers? I think that's the ongoing problem that might be worthy of your investigation is to how is the best way for at one of these shows to introduce young people who don't want to listen to an old grandpa like me, but why would they want to make the same mistakes that I've made in my lifetime if we can help them be more efficient and make their life easier because they don't have to make those mistakes. I don't have the answer to that. We don't mind chatting and trying to teach, and that's what I do. I have a kind of a little spiel, a PowerPoint that's pretty good as far as the different kind of crushers, and we've used it for years, and it's accurate. But how you get it into here and keep it going, I don't have the answer to that. I don't have the answer to that. But it's going to be an ongoing thing because as our world changes and difficulty in getting young folks interested in our industry and wanting to work in the dirt and the wind and the dust and the noise and the stuff like that. You know, it's
a challenge.
It's a challenge. It's ongoing. A challenge. Yes, it is. So,
well, Neil, with the experience and legacy you've, you know, made and left on the industry, I think all the young bucks should be lining up to listen to you, even if you think that might not be the case. But just want to say, you know, once again, congratulations on your induction into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much for spending a little time with us here today. Kevin, anything else you got for Neil?
No, just really grateful that you made the trip, and we're looking forward to seeing your enshrinement here in a few hours, Neil. Congrats again.
In the words of the immortal Willie Nelson, I thought you had to die to get into this. So I'm going to be dressed appropriately tonight.
Thanks so much again, Neil.
Thank you.
That was Neil Heiss, former owner and president of SEMCO, Pit and Quarry Hall of Fame class of 2024 inductee. Thanks again to Neil for taking a little time to talk with us. You know, I know we kind of mentioned going into it that he's just sort of a story machine. I know I was lucky enough to kind of get to talk with him for the Hall of Fame profile. Kevin, I know you know him or knew of him kind of a little bit, but you know, what were some of your takeaways from our interview with Neil?
Well, one thing that I appreciate about Neil is that he's very frank and direct, and he's not afraid to ruffle feathers. I think that's something that we had George Sidney, another Pit and Quarry Hall of Famer, in the Ag One booth of ours talk about. You know, you may not like what Neil has to say. You know, Neil would just plainly tell you how it is, you know, kind of cut through the fat. And you know, I appreciate that because I think about my own career and, you know, kind of growing into a role here at Pit and Quarry. And it's not necessarily always easy to deliver bad news or the news that people don't want to hear. But sometimes you just got to get to the point, and Neil is one to do that, and it seems unafraid to do that. I don't know if maybe he would say that there's some fear in that, but he's very frank and to the point, and you know, I appreciate that about him, and I think others do too. Maybe others would say that they don't, but sometimes you need a plain-spoken person to kind of get you focused and on where you're needing to go.
Yeah, no one's ever going to question how Neil Heiss feels on a certain topic, that's for sure.
No.
And I think that's important, you know, in many cases. So,
well, congrats again to Neil Heiss. Tom Hill, thanks again for joining us, fellas. And for additional coverage on them, you take a peek at our March issue, our May issue, which we're wrapping up here as we speak here. Jack, you know, we're filming this on April 15th and dropping this episode on April 23rd. So in the weeks that follow April 23, you're going to be able to see some photos and some recaps, some coverage from the Hall of Fame. You know, Jack, I know you were working on some content related to Neil and Tom for the print magazine and for our digital edition. So that's something that readers can look forward to as well. We also got our April editions on our desks within the last week or week and a half, I would say. Mm-hmm. We've got our roundtable supplement. It's a special pullout report that you can read, 32 pages dedicated to our February 1st and 2nd event. So, you know, a lot of content within there, and I know a lot of our listeners, you know, they were ones who attended the roundtable, so check out full highlights there. And if you didn't attend the roundtable, we'd encourage you to dive into that because we've got insights from producers, manufacturers, and dealers who all got together at our first 2024 event of the year for the magazine. And, you know, that was, you know, always a good time for us and kind of helps get our bearings on where things are for the industry and where things are going for the industry this year. Also this week, you know, as we're shooting episode 13, you know, Jack, you've got a couple of trips in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and one of which is Atlanta. You're going down to a Komatsu event, which is kind of exciting. And tell us about what you're going to experience and what you have experienced to date with Komatsu in recent months.
Yeah, so Komatsu has their, they call it their demo days, coming up at their location in Cartersville, Georgia. Heading down there for kind of a quick one-night trip. Early morning Wednesday, we're going to get out there, be able to take some photos, operate some machinery. Kind of like you mentioned, was able to get out to Tucson, Arizona back in November for what they call their quarry days at their at what they call their proving grounds. In Arizona, which was awesome. Got to get behind a couple haul trucks, I believe 100-ton and 150-ton haul truck. Probably a mistake on Komatsu's part to give me the reins of one of those things, but everything stayed intact. Everything was good.
Those are awesome opportunities.
Oh, man, it was unreal. You know, you're behind the wheel of this massive piece of equipment that somehow turns on a dime and is so responsive for as big as it is. It was an absolutely unreal experience. So I'm looking forward to getting down to Atlanta to hopefully operate some more equipment. You know, I'll likely have some photos and a write-up of the event on pitandquarry.com, and you can be on the lookout for quarry faces, photos, and, you know, anything else coming out of that event in our coverage. So appreciate Komatsu giving us the opportunity to get down there. You know, we've been cultivating a pretty good relationship with them between quarry days and now demo days. And they always put on a first-class event, so I'm looking forward to getting down there and seeing what else I can get my hands on equipment-wise.
We've got some other Ag One interviews that we still need to unpack. I know some of you have heard from Neil Schmidgoal and visits that we've had with Ag One, more young leaders potentially to come. And appreciate everybody who's engaged the podcast to date. Again, 13 episodes in, and looking forward to getting more perspective out there on how the industry is faring and more in the episodes to come. So for Jack Kapansky, I'm Kevin Yannick, and thanks for listening.
See you.